Hey, MWI podcast listeners, before we get to this episode, I've got some exciting news about a really interesting opportunity. If you follow MWI, you're almost certainly familiar with the Harding Project. Well, the Harding Fellowship prepares Army leaders to drive professional discussion. Harding Fellows earn a graduate degree and then edit their branch journals, helping to shape the ideas that shape the Army. So if you know a sharp officer, senior NCO, or warrant officer, please tell them they can learn all about this opportunity at www.lineofdeparture.army.mil/Harding.
If you look across the U.S. defense industrial base and down to that, you know, fifth and sixth tier of supply, there are so many sole or single source providers of critical components. And it's going to be very difficult, not only for the U.S. to be able to get some of the critical equipment that it might need into the Pacific, but it also might struggle to get some of the critical components that it needs out of the Indo-Pacific. I don't think the workforce issue is one that gets shouted out enough, and this is so important. Workforce is a critical problem for the defense industrial base.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point Class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and the discussion on this episode tackles a really important subject, the U.S. defense industrial base. And it features the insightful perspective of Becca Wasser, Deputy Director of the Defense Program at the Center for a New American Security. We begin by exploring just what constitutes the defense industrial base in the information age, where data and software play an increasingly prominent role alongside physical material like tanks, aircraft, and artillery shells. We explore how globalization and extended and complicated supply chains factor into defense planning. And we talk about the specific features that define a U.S. defense industrial base at its best, and how we get there, maximizing readiness for a large-scale conflict. Before we get to the discussion, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point Class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Becca Wasser. Becca, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here today.
So you work at the Center for a New American Security, where you are the Deputy Director of the Defense Program. You also spend a lot of time researching and writing about industrial policy in the defense industrial base, including a very good report that was published a couple of months ago examining the U.S. defense industrial base. And so I guess to kind of kick off the conversation, since that's what we're going to talk about, can you just sort of put some left and right limits on what are we talking about? What are the parameters? What is included in the defense industrial base today given kind of our modern economy?
I think the better question is what isn't in the defense industrial base today? There's a lot of overlap with commercial markets, albeit not as much as some would necessarily like. But when we talk about the defense industrial base, we are talking about companies who produce some of the weapon systems and platforms that we often hear about, whether those are munitions to fighter aircraft to submarines. It also includes some of the new entrants we also hear quite a lot about these days, who are producing some of the newer technology, particularly as it relates to uncrewed systems. But it also includes folks who work on things like software, particularly some of the software needed for decision support, as well as, you know, some of the core components of the larger systems that we don't necessarily think about, like semiconductors. For the report that I, and a lot of my research, I tend to focus a little bit more on the defense primes, who are the ones who produce the major weapons platforms and systems that we talk about when we're doing operational planning, wargaming, nerding out about all things defense, as well as the new entrants who are oftentimes trying to make greater use of leveraging commercial technology. And within that, some of their lower tier suppliers. So the defense industrial base is not just these big companies. It's the folks who provide some of those basic components ranging from a single widget to a screw to something much larger than that. So the defense industrial base is quite large. It's located not only all throughout America, but also all around the globe.
You answered that question perfectly because I was specifically wondering about software companies. When we think about industrial policy, about industrial, when you hear the word industrial, we think manufacturing, right? Hardware. And so obviously that's the big five. It's the Northrops, it's Lockheed's, Boeing's, but also the new entrants like Anduril with all of their uncrewed systems. And then again, the people that make the sort of fuel that makes some of these new systems run, which is the data-centric software firms. What about companies that are not principally engaged on defense issues or producing defense products, but sort of do so tangentially? You know, I just heard recently a report about Anduril partnering with Meta on a blended reality sort of simulation device for, I believe it was for the Army. Is Meta part of the defense industrial base?
Meta could be. Any company could be. This is why, you know, I started it by saying, what isn't the defense industrial base? Anything could be, with a few different caveats. One being, right now, there are some significant barriers to entry. That's why the fact that Anduril, Palantir, some of these newer entrants who seem to be the defense unicorns who are making it and actually getting contracts from the US government, it's such a big deal because for so long, it was only the defense primes that were able to actually bid on some of the contracts to produce weapons platforms. Some of what the DoD is asking for, mind you, has changed, which is when we get to things that aren't maybe these huge systems, but instead something smaller like IVAS, which you mentioned, and this sort of, you know, virtual reality training system. We're also hearing a lot more about the need for software and software packages and the US government buying into software. Palantir's Maven Smart System is a great example. It's in use in almost every single combatant command. We're also seeing some international allies purchase it, like the UK and NATO. So we're seeing that becoming a common platform for interoperability, which has its own knock-on benefits. However, all of this to say is there's almost anything that could be part of the defense industrial base. You've also seen sort of this push to try and bring in what the US government often thinks of as commercial, you know, goods. A lot of time that is software, but also, you know, some of the off-the-shelf systems. We've seen this a lot with drones, and this was what undergirded the replicator initiative that DoD put forward of trying to acquire thousands of already in existence drones, as well as now counter UAS systems. So anything can be part of it. It's just whether the US government wants it to be, because at the end of the day, the unique thing about the defense industrial base is that it has, for the most part, one customer and one customer only, and that's the US government.
You also mentioned the semiconductor industry. Obviously, you know, I think most listeners will know that Taiwan is a major player in the semiconductor industry. And so a lot of this stuff that we're buying from abroad. My sort of touch point when I think about, you know, defense industrial policy and the defense industrial base, as you think back to World War II, when there was kind of mobilization, total mobilization across the country. And, you know, it was a little bit, I don't want to say easier, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong in saying that it was easier, but when you had US companies making certain products in US facilities, globalization has sort of changed that dynamic pretty considerably. How much does that complicate, you know, planning and implementing some sort of well thought out policy when it comes to defense industry?
Oof, there is so much to dig into in that question. I love that you asked it. So let me first start with defense mobilization. I think you're right to say that it was easier in the run-up to World War II. That doesn't necessarily mean that it was easy. What people don't realize is how long, you know, DIB mobilization had actually already been happening prior to the US entering the war. So it took a long time for there to be ramp up. That being said, I think it was simpler than it would be, say, today, because of some of the relative simplicity of the weapons platforms and systems. I think here is where you are starting to see a shift within some of the thinking about design and production of particularly US weapons, where there's a push now to think about more simple design, more modular design and production. So in case there needs to be a ramp up, it could be done a little bit faster. That being said, you are also 100% right that there is an increasing amount of U.S. supply chains that are critical to the defense industrial base that exist overseas. You know, semiconductors in Taiwan being, the most key probably example in the public sphere. I actually, several years ago, ran a war game looking at what would happen if the U.S. and China were to get into a conflict as it relates to semiconductors and what that would mean in terms of knock-on effects. And in any potential conflict, there's going to be severe restrictions, if not retraction, of global supply chains. We've already seen during COVID-19 that supply chains easily become stretched because they are so brittle. I think we've already seen more recently with tariffs, for example, some of the knock-on effects on supply chains. If there were to be a no-kidding shooting war in the Indo-Pacific, things are going to get a lot trickier. It's not only the tyranny of distance problem, but it is the fact that it's going to be a really, really contested, punchy environment. And it's going to be very difficult, not only for the US to be able to get some of the critical equipment that it might need into the Pacific, but it also might struggle to get some of the critical components that it needs out of the Indo-Pacific. And this is why you've actually had a push for onshoring. That honestly started several years ago, and there was major efforts within the Biden administration to do so. And we're seeing those take a slightly different tenor, but a greater emphasis on it during the Trump administration as well. So there's this need to shore up supply chains, both globally, because you are going to want some things at the point of potential need, but also have a needed redundancy to make sure that you can actually produce some of the most critical things at home in the United States.
You've written about four attributes of an effective defense industrial base, and you've kind of been hinting at them or talking about them without mentioning them specifically over the past couple of answers that you've given. And I want to touch on those, but before we do, I want to ask one more sort of, I guess, kind of broad framing question, and that's ultimately this is about industrial policy, right? The U.S. government's ability to have some say over the production and procurement of the outputs of the defense industrial base. Industrial policy, is that, you know, I guess, have we sort of forgotten how to do that because of, you know, 20 years of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where things were basically, with a few exceptions that we'll talk about, pretty stable in terms of what we needed and the kind of evolutionary development of new technologies rather than the revolutionary development of new technologies, which were required by, you know, protracted large-scale combat operations. So have we forgotten how to do industrial policy, or at least how to sync it with the process of developing strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I wish that we had enough time for me to trace the whole history, but all I will say is that in the post-Cold War environment, we forgot how integral industrial policy is to defense strategy and operations. And I think it is for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. There was this sense of relative complacency as the U.S. was the world's superpower. I think there was a question over what the U.S. military and the defense industrial base needed to be prepared for. And as we were in more of an era of responsive operations and military operations other than war, you know, what was needed was relatively easy, and the U.S. already had to be able to counter or at least deter some of the adversaries it faced or conduct the interventions that it wanted to conduct overseas. So for me, I think as someone who's a relative neophyte when it comes down to knowing things about the industrial base, I'm more of a defense strategist and operations person by background and training. The biggest takeaway for me was just the major disconnect between the national defense strategy and the operational concepts that are supposed to undergird it and industrial reality. Right now, the two are not linked in the way that they should be. And I think it's taken, you know, Ukraine, for example, to start to drive home the message of how important the defense industrial base is to any way that the U.S. can actually shore up its security, deter adversaries, and to remind folks that all of this is not necessarily a given. So now we have a greater emphasis on the defense industrial base, but the question becomes, what are we trying to position it toward? Is it actually prepared for the potential for great power conflict? And if so, some of the expected dynamics of that, the potential for a protracted war with, say, China, or the fact that we could find ourselves in a simultaneous conflict where you have greater cooperation among China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, you name it. All of these things compound what the defense industrial base might need to be prepared to do in support of the national defense strategy. And the disconnect is still a wide, wide chasm. And that's something that we're going to have to figure out how to overcome and start to find better ways to integrate both government and industry into some of those planning discussions.
And what are the best sort of demand signals that the U.S. government can send to, you know, to hopefully trigger a response from a responsive industrial base?
Well, if I can be really glib, the U.S. government can buy their damn weapons. That's the number one demand signal. That is the easiest one. And I think sometimes we take that for granted, particularly when it comes down to some of the way that the service requirements are generated and how that translates into actual procurement and budget line items, the role that Congress can have when it comes down to attempted divestment, but also their ability to plus up various things. There seems to be a frenetic demand signal, and all of this can sometimes go in the right direction where Congress can say, no, you need to purchase munitions. But sometimes it can go in the wrong way where they say, no, you cannot retire this many A-10s. So having a steadier demand signal where the services actually buy what they say they need for their operational concepts, where you have Congress being able to get behind some of these plans, and if you know, the DOD and the services don't follow through, be able to reinforce that. Those are essential for at least saying, here's what we expect, and here's what you need to at least produce. And that sends a signal to industry that they need to invest in the facilities, the long lead items, the components, start to get contracts with some of their sub-tier suppliers, start to work all of that so that they have the on-hand capacity to be able to start to churn out these weapons as needed. To me, that's kind of the most basic way that you could have an increased demand signal. But I do think that there is something to be said about a more integrated approach between the U.S. government and industry, where you do have at least an earlier conversation about some of the operational concepts, about some of the strategies for, you know, deterrence and warfighting in the Indo-Pacific, where perhaps they're part of war games. They actually see and understand some of the potential requirements and what could be needed overall, because that would also perhaps cause industry to start thinking a little bit more about investing some of their own capital, investing some of their own funds into research and development, into increased facilitation. All of that means that we need to have greater preparedness, but we're not having a conversation that allows for that kind of preparedness.
Well, you mentioned capacity, and which is the first in this list of four attributes that I said you've written about that kind of characterize an effective and healthy defense industrial base. So let's kind of take them one by one and talk about, you know, with the state of play right now, what's maybe holding us back from a defense industrial base characterized by that particular attribute and what we can do going forward. The first one is, as you said, capacity. And again, you know, if you look back at World War II when we had factories building P-38s and P-51s versus now producing F-35s, you know, P-38s, P-51s could be, given the technology involved, they could be produced quite quickly and at pretty reasonable costs, you know, certainly in the thousands, you're not talking about the millions. Whereas the F-35, when it was the first copies were being delivered, we were talking about 90 to a million $90 to $100 million per aircraft, per airframe. How do you, given the increased technology, the increased time it takes to produce these products and the increased cost, how do you build capacity around that?
Yeah, I mean, part of this is, you know, what capacity looks like for different types of systems is a little bit different. You know, when you do have something that is a little bit more simple, you can have some of the ability to ramp your capacity to be able to produce them a little bit easier, as you said. But when it is really complex, capacity looks very different. I think there are some essential components of it. One is having the available facilities, having the available items. These are the components that go into weapons production. These are things ranging from energetic material to semiconductors to, you know, steel and things that you might actually need. It's trying to get those. And it's also trying to do some procurement of longer lead items, solid rocket motors, for example, that you find in drones, munitions, you know, some much smaller aircraft, aeronautical systems. Those have been in hot demand. And the U.S. government has started to try and think about how they can increase capacity by eventually maybe moving towards qualifying new suppliers. But what they've done in the interim is they've provided test contracts to additional companies. So what they're doing essentially is trying to not move towards full procurement or qualification of new suppliers, but instead introduce a little bit more competition if needed in order to try and expand capacity. I will say, I don't think the workforce issue is one that gets shouted out enough, and this is so important. Workforce is a critical problem for the defense industrial base. It's uneven across the defense industrial base, where you have certain sectors like shipbuilding, for example, that are a lot more pressed to find available workforce, in part because of where the shipyards are located and they've already maxed out on who they can go to. So there needs to be greater buy-in, frankly, from the American public into the types of jobs that the defense industry actually needs. And so here there's a lot that could be done when it comes down to developing a workforce, greater workforce that is able to help the production of different types of systems, because we're going to need a diverse array of systems. But that's going to change. That's going to require changing some paradigms as to how we think about the defense industrial base, how we think about education, and some of the encouragement that could be provided within schools or by the U.S. government or even by industry when it comes down to some of the jobs ranging from welders to engineers. So
to coders and software developers.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, and this goes back to the point of it just being such a broad based industry. There's something in there for everyone, but we don't necessarily put the idea that working in the defense industrial base is part of public service in the way that perhaps I would argue we need to. I think we had that sense of pride previously. You know, you look at posters of Rosie the Riveter, you know, in World War II, you had women who were part of the defense industrial workforce. You had everyone who was contributing to what was then a war effort. But after that, we sort of changed how we thought about defense industrial jobs. And public service took the form of working directly for the U.S. government or fighting within the U.S. military. But at the same time, contributing to the production of the weapons that are needed to help keep America safe and, frankly, ensure global stability, to me, that is public service in itself. So perhaps maybe as we start to change the conversation around this, it might also make the defense industrial base a little bit more attractive to some folks who want to contribute to something much larger than themselves and to give back to their country.
So I want to switch then to the second attribute that you talked about, and that's responsiveness. And, you know, when in 2003, obviously, the U.S. led a coalition into Iraq, and it wasn't long before they started confronting the threat of IEDs, improvised explosive devices, on the battlefield. And then there was this sort of tactical game, cat and mouse game of innovation that happened on the side, on the part of the insurgents who were using them, and the coalition forces trying to protect themselves against them. By, you know, I think 2005, 2006, we started getting explosively formed penetrators, deep buried IEDs, sometimes thousands of pounds of explosives deep underneath, and they were wreaking havoc with even the up-armored Humvees that we, that most of our forces were driving around the battlefield in. And we ultimately produced the mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicle, the MRAP. If you read Bob Gates's memoir, Duty, he talks a lot about that and what a success story it was fielding that. They protected soldiers from, they had a V-shaped held to project, or protected soldiers from blasts coming from deep buried IEDs, suspended seats so that the shockwaves didn't go up through your body and fracture bones in your back, for instance. It had heavier armor, all kinds of things. But it still took 2 years to sort of produce, since we identified the need to the time we fielded them. That was fast enough for the pace of that innovation game that was taking place between insurgents and the coalition forces. That's nowhere near fast enough to keep up with innovation, the pace of the innovation kind of game that we're seeing unfold, say, in Ukraine. So how do you build a defense industrial base that is responsive enough to keep pace with modern war?
Isn't that the million-dollar question at the moment? You know, I think you've cited a great example, and it's the one that we often talk about. But to me, I think there's something that isn't totally a good news story about the MRAP, which is the fact that it took the Secretary of Defense to lead that effort to make that happen. It required a senior leader at the highest levels of the Department of Defense to actually push that through. That is not going to be the case as we are trying to find different ways of developing new systems, confronting new operational challenges, having to shift very regularly as it relates to changes on the battlefield. That's just not going to fly, and that's going to create a bottleneck for senior leader decision-making that just won't be possible as we are looking at what we expect to be a greater fast pace of future conflict. So here, I think there's something to be said about needing to take steps to be able to surge production of some of the things that we already have, that we already need, right? Again, I've mentioned a bunch of them. It's having that on-hand capacity, having spare capacity to be able to ramp up as needed. It's having some of those long lead items and available materials, workforce facilities, and whatnot. But it is also, to your point, being able to innovate and being able to do so in a much more seamless manner. And to me, this is where software, for example, could play a key role, where you can push out upgrades and updates as needed to be able to keep a system flying, to be able to make it have an attribute that you might think it needs at that given time, which might not have been how you thought about it when you were initially developing that system. There's also something to be said about, again, some of the push for developing more simple and almost modular systems where you can see, where you could almost have what you've seen Ukraine do, where they're creating these Franken-Sams and other Franken-systems, where you can almost have this plug-and-play moment where you can actually start to develop something that, again, it's different from how it was initially conceived, but it might be what it is that you actually need at that point. This is a tricky problem. And again, as we think to like the potential for a protracted war and the fact that you will have not only the rate of battlefield attrition and consumption to have to contend with, you also will have almost these periods of intense fighting and then pulling back either for reconstitution, but also for innovation. And so that's going to present more new problems in a really cyclical way that I think we need to start thinking a little bit more about how we're going to almost back engineer our solutions to those problems. And that's just not how we think about acquisition. That's not how we think about production. That's not, frankly, how we think about weapon systems when we first design them. More often than not, they are exquisite. And, you know, sometimes the services can't even repair them. themselves. So it's trying to sort of break some of the ways in which we've traditionally been doing things in order to have the ability to respond and to be a little bit more flexible about how we're approaching what it is that we have in our arsenal.
So attribute number three, you talk about flexibility. One of my bad habits is I end up going down the Wikipedia rabbit hole a little bit too easily. And somehow I ended up on the Wikipedia page for Speed Queen, which was a company formed in the early 20th century in Wisconsin. They made laundry machines, washers and dryers, what have you. During World War II, they made 20-millimeter shells, parts for airplanes and parts for tanks. Given, as you mentioned, how much more exquisite the systems we employ, the platforms we employ are now, you're not likely to see a washing machine factory converted overnight to be making parts for the F-35 or an Abrams tank. So what does flexibility look like given that context of much more exquisite systems and platforms?
Yeah, I think we have to acknowledge the fact that there's going to be a diversity of systems that are needed, right? We're going to have these exquisite systems that we think of often as our crown jewels, but at the same time, there's been a push more towards these attritable low-cost systems that would enable the United States to be able to fight, hopefully for longer, to present new problems to a would-be adversary, but also more simple systems, often leveraging commercial technology. So I think there's something to be said about, again, it's breaking sort of an existing paradigm of how we've traditionally thought of the DIB and how the US government has sought to procure things. But that in itself allows for a greater flexibility. I think there's also more flexibility that can be done in terms of production. I think leveraging things like new manufacturing techniques is one way to go ahead. You know, I've done some work where in this report, I've got a case study on how to ramp up production of 155-millimeter shells, which have been so in desire in Ukraine, mm-hmm. but also requested by Israel at the start of its conflict in the Middle East. Also, Taiwan has requested 155 at one point. So thinking about how we could leverage commercial manufacturing to produce more shells. And there you can actually make great use of commercial sand casting facilities if you decided to shift from forging to casting shells. So there are some things that can be done. It just, again, it's not doing business as normal. And so this is, I think, at the heart of what needs to happen, which is we need to just approach things a little bit differently. And companies need to get on board with that, but also the US government needs to make it a little bit easier to be able to do so because there are so many strict rules and regulations around what you can do, what you can't do. Right now, you have to forge 155 shells. You can't cast them. They're not seen as being good enough for military use. But even with an expedited testing and evaluation process, it's seeming as though, you know, they're still pretty good, if not sometimes even better. So thinking again, how do we actually make this happen? And it just means doing things differently. But I think you and I both know that is so hard for the DoD to do in more ways than one.
So then if we shift gears to the fourth attribute you talked about, it is resilience. And, you know, I guess another anecdote, this one not about my terrible Wikipedia rabbit hole habit. Do you remember during COVID, there was a cargo ship called the Ever Given that got stuck in the Suez Canal.
Yeah.
And I happened to be trying to buy a bike at the time. And it turned out, at least I read this, I don't know how true it was, but it turned out, you know, there are only three main manufacturers of some of the components that's on most bikes in the world. Shimano, SRAM, and Campagnolo make all the derailleurs and lots of other components on a bike. Well, apparently one of the things that ship had on it was a bunch of, I believe it was derailleurs from Shimano. And so suddenly all these bike manufacturers didn't have this one critical piece, and the bike can't be shipped without it, obviously. Given our reliance on certain components and things that are made by a very small set of manufacturers. And we're talking about TSMC, you know, the Taiwanese company that makes semiconductors, but also the machines that make those semiconductors are all produced by, the lithography machines are all produced by one Dutch company that has, you know, the tooling and expertise necessary to produce it. How do you build resilience in the defense industrial base when you're facing that fact that higher technology means less and less players are going to be able to be involved in production of some of these high-end exquisite things?
I think it's even true for some of the simple systems, right? You've cited a high-tech example, but if you look across the U.S. defense industrial base and down to that, you know, fifth and sixth tier of supply, there are so many sole or single source providers of critical components. And again, sometimes it is a screw. Sometimes it is a door frame. Sometimes it is something that seems so basic, but there is only one company that produces it, one company that knows how to produce it, and one company that has technology from like the 1950s that is still ongoing and is what is needed to do it. So it's not just our international supply chains, it's the US supply chain as well, where we don't have redundancy, where we have some of these gaps that you could easily see that if something were to happen, there were to be a generational retirement, a company was to experience a break and buy and go bankrupt. I mean, we're essentially SOL at that point. And you can see the knock-on effects. So it's a really hard problem set. And I think sometimes we rightfully point to the international supply chains, but we don't necessarily think as hard about some of those small businesses, those mom and pop shops that actually make up the predominance of the defense industrial base in the United States. And but I will say, I think we had two very different COVID experiences. You were trying to buy a bike. I was trying to hoard toilet paper from Costco.
So I guess, how do you do that then? Because if there is one sort of small mom and pop company, say in Mississippi, that's making that door frame or that screw or some other widget, you know, and they're the ones that have the know-how, you know, it's a big ask to go to them and say, hey, can you share this technology with another company who's going to compete with you? And even if you promise, we're still going to buy, you know, as much as we currently do from you, but we just want to buy more from them, this new company as well. You know, that you can't necessarily count on being able to do that. So how do you encourage sort of diversification in the defense industrial base?
Yeah, the defense industrial base, one of the least competitive markets known to man at this moment. So I think there's something to be said about competition, but I also think there's something to be said about having some steadiness to provide these small companies. Oftentimes, it's just not attractive for them to be part of the defense industry. They can make more money in the commercial world. They don't have to experience some of the frenetic up and down that happens when you have things like sequestration or perhaps, you know, a procurement contract doesn't come through. I mentioned before breaks and buys. Sometimes that is what has led to some massive exits from some of these smaller businesses. So it's having that steady demand signal is really essential to them. But I would also argue that, again, it's thinking about different ways of doing things. Is there a way in which, rather than relying on some of this existing but maybe outdated technology, can we leverage things like additive manufacturing? Can we think about ways to make it so that instead of issuing a, you know, a sole source contract, instead we do have some dual sourcing to build in redundancy? Traditionally, the U.S. government has shied away from that in terms of preferring efficiency, and dual sourcing does require funds, but there's value in perhaps being able to do it, particularly if we are not only trying to create a resilient defense industrial base, but we're also trying to massively surge the production of weapons in order to enhance that deterrence balance. So there's lots of reasons to do it. It's just a decision that needs to be made about how to do it and whether to do it. And that ultimately is a question for the U.S. government.
Well, which leads seamlessly into the next question that I want to ask you, because we've been talking about industrial policy and the defense industrial base, and it's really about coordinating the government with private industry, right? But the government is not a monolithic actor. And sometimes sort of the sub-elements within the government are working at cross-purposes. You know, listeners will be familiar, most listeners, I think, with the A-10. If you're in the army and you serve in Iraq or Afghanistan at any point, you probably have a love affair with the A-10 because it's a brilliant close air support aircraft, but it's very slow. It's not necessarily optimized for the sort of high intensity, large scale combat operations that the U.S. military is planning for now. And so for a number of years, the Air Force has been trying to divest itself of those aircraft. And Congress has been saying, no, we're not going to do that. So can you talk a little bit about how we can get the services, the executive branch, Congress with its purse strings, all kind of pulling in the same direction in some coordinated fashion?
If I could figure out how to do that, I would have it made in Washington, D.C. And I probably would not be getting a think tank salary. But all of that to be said, I think there's something about having greater communication and coordination. A lot of times what we've heard from Congress is an upset that they haven't been communicated with, that the reasons for doing things such as divesting of the A-10s have not been made clear to them. Does not necessarily mean that they're going to get on board with the plan. But I think we found with other initiatives, slightly different, but AUKUS, for example, when there's a lot of effort to actually communicate with Congress and to let them know what the intent is and how this provides unique value, they tend to get on board. It's obviously a little bit more complicated with an example like the A-10, where you do have some folks who have factories in certain districts, but there's choices that can be made. Does that mean that that factory transitions from producing the A-10 to another weapons platform, another system, another airframe? There are these trades that can be had because at the end of the day, the number one thing that some members of Congress care the most about are their constituents, and rightfully so. But oftentimes we do get into this weird game with Congress as it relates to the defense industrial base, where they want to protect the DIB interests within their district, but it's just, or their state. And it's just trying to make sure that there's a clear narrative as to why this decision is being made and what the potential trade-offs can be in terms of, you know, whether that means if a factory is going away, jobs are going away, what else can be done? And as we are in this current stage where we are looking to ramp up the defense industrial base, I think we have to think of it almost as substitution. So again, what else can be made at that factory? How can you change that factory floor to produce something else? Can you leverage the existing tooling, the existing workforce know-how to do something that is more in line with what the DoD or the services are thinking?
So you've touched on a number of things. Encourage competition, build inventories and stockpiles, generate consistent demand. These are all among eight specific recommendations that you highlight in the report that I mentioned that was published by CNAS a handful of weeks ago. That report is called From Production Lines to Front Lines, Revitalizing the U.S. Defense Industrial Base for Future Great Power Conflict. We're not going to go one by one through all of those recommendations, but I would encourage listeners to go read it because it is, I mentioned to you before we started recording that it has become a really, really useful primer to me. Because we publish a lot of content at MWI. Not a lot of it is specifically on the defense industrial base, but a lot of it touches on it. There's these sort of underlying assumptions about it. It is tangentially related to so much, arguably almost all of what we do as a joint force, as an army, that I think it's really, really important. So I'd encourage listeners to go and check that out if they have any other questions or want to read about those specific recommendations. I do want to ask you kind of to close out one final question. This is a conversation that we weren't having for a long time. I think the fact that we have reduced stockpiles of certain systems, certain ammunition so dramatically because of supplying Ukraine, but also, as you mentioned, Israel and its ongoing campaign against Hamas. We're starting to have this conversation, which is the first step. But can you kind of provide a snapshot of, you know, are things starting to materialize? Are we starting to take steps in the right direction? Or is this still kind of a conceptual search for an answer that still has yet to be even take the initial steps toward implementation?
I think it's a mix of both. I think right now we are seeing some steps, but they're not going far enough. They are very incremental, and they're almost as though we are in a different phase. These are the types of steps that I would have liked to have seen in, say, the late 1990s, early to mid 2000s. That is not where we are today, where we actually do have a incredibly modernized military competitor. So there's something to be said about perhaps maybe thinking with a little bit more urgency and a little bit more creative approach to things. So I think, you know, trying to get after this problem is a good one. And I applaud the US government for some of the steps that it has been taking. I applaud them for trying to introduce more competition into the defense industrial base. I applaud them for understanding the importance of having industrial capacity in America. But I would urge them to take a few steps forward, to not just admire the problem, to not just talk about it. It's great that we're starting to talk about it in the right way, but now we need to do more in order to get after it. And so here, I think it's just, we're starting to take steps, but it's not quite enough. And there is an urgency of the problem because of some of the long timelines that it takes to ramp up production, to develop new systems, to break barriers, to change regulation, to start thinking about how we can actually leverage commercial industry, develop new workforce. All of these things just take time. So there's something to be said about maybe we are no longer complacent, but we aren't necessarily moving with the type of urgency that is required because all of this is a lengthy process. So I think both things can be true. And I think that's where we find ourselves, where we are taking some incremental steps, but they're not nearly enough and they're not moving fast enough.
Well, I think we will leave it there. Becca, I want to thank you again for joining me. It's been a fascinating discussion for me, and I trust listeners will find it equally fascinating.
Great. Thanks again for having me.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.